All right. Well, thanks everybody for coming. Right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, a process that is, I guess, at the heart of this workshop, and that is, you know, how actually galaxies form and evolve through cosmic times, and what are the main drivers for their behavior. And I wanted to start off with this is a lunch talk, right? So I will make this very informal. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to show you this cool.
Is it you?
It's sadly not me driving. But this is really a facility now, ALMA, that is changing the way we can study the distant universe. Okay. And this cannot be overemphasized. Of course, everybody's unhappy that they don't get the time they want, right? But you know, we just have to be patient, I guess, and hang in there for just a little longer. Because it is really producing spectacular results. In particular, when we think about the high redshift universe, there's an entirely new parameter space that is opening up. So this is a National Geographic clip. They're like, you see, this is a time-lapse movie, obviously, but you see that the telescopes are very rapidly moving, and they actually do that also in real time, right? When you see them move, it's just unbelievable how quickly they move. You consider that one of them weighs as much as two Boeing 737s. Right. So I want to really talk about this general topic today with, you know, a huge number of collaborators. I want to just particularly highlight Manuel Aravena, who is co-PI of our significant ALMA program, and Roberto De Carli, who is a postdoc at MPAA, who has worked a lot on this, and he's outstanding, and he's Italian.
Is it good or bad?
That's actually good. You know, of course, you have all seen this plot many times, but I think it's good to recap what we are trying to do. Of course, we try to understand how galaxies formed and evolved, starting in the epoch of reionization, and then how the galaxy buildup actually took place over the last 10 gigayears or so, and how we end up with the universe today. And of course, as we also heard the other day from Robert, the real change over the last decade or so is that we have these excellent suite of hydrodynamical simulations of cosmic structure formation. I'm just showing, you know, some Arepo snapshots here. But really, what all these simulations have in common, and Robert obviously talked about this, is that the galaxies, they grow through gas accretion, okay? And it's also true that this gas content, in particular at high redshift, is currently really pretty much unconstrained. So one plot that, you know, dozens and dozens of groups have been working on over the last two decades is the cosmic star formation history plot. So what's plotted here on the y-axis is the volume averaged star formation rate in solar masses per year per cubic megaparsecs as a function of redshift, and on the top y-axis we have the lookback time in gigayears. So present day, this number is about 0.01 solar masses per year per cubic megaparsec. This makes sense. Our galaxy forms stars at about one solar mass per year. You know, Andromeda is maybe the same, a megaparsec away or so, twiddle, right? So this is a number to keep in mind. And then, of course, you know, there's this dramatic increase or decrease, if you go with cosmic time, by a factor 20 or so, which peaks at around redshift 2, the epoch of galaxy assembly. And then there is the drop, the apparent drop towards very high galaxy, very high redshift. And of course, there's some very interesting debate ongoing at redshift 8 or 9. And now even 10, whether there's an additional drop or whether this trend continues. I mean, the thing to really keep in mind here is this has been the effort of, you know, really two decades of various observations from across all the wavelengths, okay, from the radio to the UV. So this is sort of the picture that has emerged after this huge effort. And I guess one of the key questions is really what is the fundamental cause for this evolution? And we will talk about that today. Just zooming in here in the latter part of the cosmic star formation history, You can, of course, do much more than just measuring the total star formation rate. You can also ask, you know, what kind of objects give rise to the star formation? And at redshift zero, right, you see that, for example, the ULURCs, which are defined as infrared luminosities above 10 to the 12 solar masses, or roughly, you know, 100 solar masses per year, they're a negligible contributor at redshift zero, but they really are a main contributor at redshift two, okay? Which actually caused a lot of confusion originally, because, you know, when you think of a ULURC at redshift zero, everybody thinks up to 20-ish, right? And that is obviously a merger. And we know that these mergers, they are very efficient in forming stars, and that then gives rise to these very high star formation rates. And we will see in a second that the high redshift ULURCs are very different. But before we do that, I just wanted to highlight, you know, one paper that we put on AstroPH a couple of days ago by Nick Scoville, where we now have very high resolution 40 parsec imaging of the two nuclei of RP20 with ALMA. And what you see here is this remarkably regular structure and rotation, even though this thing is interacting and doing, you know, forming stars at incredible rates. The overall kinematics, these are precision velocity diagrams, and the overall structure looks remarkably similar, just as an aside. Anyway, if we look at the galaxy main sequence at redshift zero, you know, there's lots of studies. I'm just showing one of here based on Aegis and Cosmos. What's plotted here is on the y-axis the star formation rate, on the x-axis the stellar mass. And you see that these galaxies you know, form some sort of relation. If you plot our own Milky Way on this plot, we're a little bit below that main sequence, the so-called green valley. And of course, you know, things that lie above this sequence are the starbursts. So here we're talking star formation rates of, you know, up to 100 or so, and then the massive ellipticals, the so-called red and dead galaxies. So this has been done for many different redshifts using, again, very different studies. And what all these studies have in common is that, again, this is redshift 0, 0.5, 1, 1.5, and 2, that there's this overall shift in this relation. So things form more stars for a given stellar mass at high redshift than today. There's some very interesting second-order effects, whether the slope is changing. But, you know, we will not have time to talk about that today. But, you know, this is a general trend that you find in these studies. Another way to look at this is, you know, a nice plot by Mark Sargent. Now, this is on the y-axis, the specific star formation rate, which is, when, if we go back, is just the ratio of the star formation rate and the stellar mass here. So, you know, you put the ratio on the y-axis and the redshift on the x-axis, and you see that the star formation rate per stellar mass is increasing, as we have just seen in the previous plot, right? And then you can also, for a given redshift, you can slice for a given redshift and a given stellar mass, you can slice across the main sequence, and this is what you get. There's this main sequence which dominates the total number of galaxies, and then there's always the starburst component that is above the main sequence. The starburst component, in terms of numbers, is really only 2% of the total number of galaxies, but in terms of star formation rate, it is a significant contributor of order 10%. And most of these very luminous sources that we know at high redshift are, in fact, in the starburst component. But, you know, the thing to keep in mind, if we go back to this definition, a ULURC, right, is, let's say, 100 solar masses per year, star formation rate at redshift zero. And of course, that's independent of redshift because it's a far infrared luminosity definition. So you immediately see that if you go to redshift one or two, most of your main sequence galaxies are in this classical definition ULURC. But are they all mergers, right? The answer is no. And this has been done, again, through various studies. One of them, for example, is just studying using high-resolution AGST imaging, the optical imaging, the optical structure, by just fitting surge indices to the HST images. So the different colors here go from a disk-like structure to an elliptical, the Vaucouleurs structure. Again, for different redshifts, 0, 1, and 2, You see again, things shift up as they should. This is exactly the same plot as I've shown before, but now color-coded. You see that the things that lie on the main sequence have regular disk structure. And of course, you know, what is important is also to get kinematic proof for this. And this has been huge efforts, both using the VLT by the Gensel group, but also using Keck, Caltech, where when you look at the rotation of the objects and the velocity fields that are shown here, they are really very regular rotating objects that have the morphology of a disk. So this, of course, doesn't mean that all the main sequence galaxies are disk galaxies, but a large fraction of them are in rotating disks and not mergers. So this then really leads to this fundamental question. It's a very simple question, right? If these high-redshift main sequence galaxies really are not mergers but disks, but they have very high star formation rates, such as the low-redshift Eulerks, what causes the star formation rate? Yeah. And you know, you could think it could just be a very efficient star formation process, so they are very efficient in forming stars of their molecular gas, or they could simply have very massive gas reservoirs, which then gives rise to the high star formation rates. And of course, you know, and you all know this, but of course we want to look at the cause for the star formation, and that is the molecular gas. This half slide sort of summarizes work that I've been involved in over the last 10 years, and that is basically plotting on the y-axis the star formation surface density, on the x-axis the molecular gas surface density. This is based on the THINGS H1 survey and the Heracles CO survey that I've been leading. And what you see here, through 50,000 measurements, 1 kiloparsec resolution, that there is a pretty good relation between star formation rate and molecular gas. So this plot is sort of the reason why we think it makes sense to look at the molecular gas phase at high redshift to learn something about the star formation. So you could say, well, if that was indeed the case, if there's this great relation, then maybe the answer to the question is pretty simple. What we want to understand is what causes the star formation history. And so far, what people have studied is the result of the star formation process, right? This is already star formation happening when we observe the galaxies. I will argue, and I have argued in the past, that the more fundamental plot is just replacing the y-axis instead of showing the star formation rate and really show the fuel of molecular gas in these objects. And it's really a priori not clear, what this relationship should look like, right? It could be following, of course, the star formation rate. It could be just flat. It could follow the stellar mass buildup. The question is, of course, how do we get there? And we get there through measurements of the molecular gas phase. And this is just an SED of M82, just to remind everybody which wavelength range we're talking about. We're talking about the far infrared regime, where there's a bunch of important lines, for example, the C+ line, but then also the CO lines that are quite important to measure the molecular gas content. So the problem with H2 is that we has no permanent dipole moment in the cold phase. We cannot really observe H2. And this is the only reason why we look at CO, right? CO is not a particularly great tracer. It's just the one that we have. And you can have endless discussions on how good that tracer is. It's just the one we have, okay? It's a reasonable tracer, I would argue, of the cold and dense gas. And when I say cold, I mean actually less than 100 Kelvin, which is different from most of the simulators. There are a few caveats you need to really keep in mind. And that is, of course, one is the conversion. We measure CO, but we really want H2. This is the infamous conversion factor, which is known to be a function of temperature, density, and metallicity. And we, of course, Rafa talked about this, and I'm sure others have also talked about this, the difficulties associated with this. And then the other issue is that there is different excitation levels. So the CO line comes in various rotational transitions. They're to first order a multiple of 115 gigahertz, which is 2.7 millimeters. And then depending on the excitation, you observe these various levels. I should also mention that there are alternative tracers that I don't have time to talk about, but Rafa talked about this. I'm sure Alberto will talk about it next week. The dust emission, for example, or also C plus has been involved. So this disadvantage of the CO transition that it comes in various different levels is actually a great advantage, it turns out, right? Because if you look at how these transitions change their observable frequencies as a function of redshift, this is the plot that you get. So on the y-axis we have the observed frequencies of the various lines. On the x-axis we have the redshift, and the things just move as rest frequency over 1 plus c, right? But you see, for example, if there was only the CO 1 to 0 line, you know, we would have a really hard time, you know, observing this line, for example, with our favorite millimeter telescope at significant redshift. But luckily, you know, we have a higher J line. I'm just putting to the CO 7 to 6 line, but as Simona knows, there's much higher J lines as well. And then also the C plus line, which has a rest frequency of 1.9 terahertz, and then is conveniently shifted to accessible bands with ALMA and Plateau de Bure and NOEMA at above redshift 6. Okay. We have, you know, a number of really tier, and oops, you of course know most of them. That's for the high J and the high redshift part. It is the NOEMA and ALMA, and now, and for the low J transitions, we can also use the Jansky Very Large Array. The collecting areas are similar, but the lines are much fainter, so it's really hard to do this kind of stuff with a VLA. Okay. So this is already a little outdated. This is a plot that Chris Carilli and I put together for our annual review article, but the basic picture still holds. So what's plotted here on the y-axis is the commutative number of objects that are detected in any molecular line. On the x-axis, it's just a year. And what you see is that this field basically didn't exist about 10 years ago, okay? It is really only happening now that we have a significant sample of galaxies, and in particular, main sequence galaxies, because in the beginning, everything was, you know, all the studies were concentrated on the quasars and the submillimeter galaxies, which are arguably interesting, but, you know, they don't really tell you about the general galaxy population. So today, there's about 80 more galaxies added to this plot, mostly through the FIPS and FIPS2 efforts at NOEMA. Very few, actually, few additions by ALMA. Okay, this has been, ALMA has not been really producing as many lines as we hoped for. But the thing to keep in mind is that whenever you hear talk about, you know, molecular gas properties in high redshift and how things change and evolve, this is really based on less than 100 galaxies total, right? And compare this to the millions of redshifts from Sloan, or, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands of redshifts in just Cosmos. I mean, this field is way behind, okay? This is just something we just have to acknowledge. This will change, right? And this, you know, ALMA was built, for one of the reasons it was built was to do this, but it's just slow going. And the other thing to keep in mind is, unlike deep fields like Cosmos or UDF, this is all targeted observations, right? This means, like, okay, I think I want to study how much molecular gas is in this particular galaxy. You know, you point at that position on the sky, you tune to the right frequency, and you hope to detect CO or C+. So there's a pretty massive pre-selection bias, I would say, in all these studies. Yes, Crystal.
I mean, you have a lot of different types of objects plotted on those histograms. Hmm. Which ones would you say are actually main sequence?
Right, sorry, galaxies? I should have said this. This is really what's called here the color selective galaxies, which is this light blue thing, right? So, and this number has increased. There's another 80 or so galaxies. Now, this bin has increased dramatically, and I will show some of the results. But this basically is a matter of sensitivity. These things are much fainter than the quasars or the submillimeter galaxies. So let me just try to put things a little bit into context here. So what's shown here is, you know, the so-called star formation law plot, or, you know, Schmidt-Kennicott, or there's various incarnations. So what I'm plotting here on the y-axis is the Fierfeld luminosity, which is the first order approximation of the star formation rate. On the x-axis, the CO luminosity, which to first order is a proxy for the H2 mass. So this is where, you know, the redshift zero spirals lie. And when you do this in a spatially resolved matter, as I've shown you before, this is sort of what we get, right? So this is based on the 40,000 individual measurements. Now, if we now add in the main sequence galaxies at redshift 1.5 or 2, they lie here, okay? Of course, these are more massive objects. But the very interesting thing, what you note immediately, is, hey, I can fit this there with a pretty simple relation, just a linear slope one line, which is a good fit. And the depletion time, if you can keep in mind, is a very easy number to remember, is about 1 giga year. So at the current star formation rate, the reservoir is being used up in 1 giga year. You can now plot the ratio of gas mass to stellar mass as a function of redshift just for these main sequence galaxies. I'm not talking any starbursts here. And this is the plot that you get. And this was also, of course, already mentioned by Eva and others. So on the y-axis is just m gas over m stars. So one means equal amount of gas as stars. On the x-axis, we have redshift. And the number that we know is the right one for the local universe is 10%, 0.1. This is also what we find in our own galaxy. And then you see that there's this dramatic increase by a factor of 10 out to redshift 2. So the gas fraction really increases based on these main sequence galaxies quite dramatically.
So is this the answer to one of the two questions that you gave?
We will get there. So the answer is partly yes.
These gas masses are H2 masses or are...
So this is all based on CO measurements using a conversion factor and translating this to an H2 mass. There's no account for H1 at all. And, you know, right, so this is the situation for the main sequence galaxies. If you add in, you know, stuff above the main sequence, like the local starburst and the local ULERGs and the high redshift starbursts and the high redshift quasars, you know, you get this population of sources, of course, above that relation. And you can also choose to fit that relation with a very simple, so you ignore the main sequence galaxies, you just fit the starburst. It also roughly fits, you know, slope one relation, but of course the depletion time is a factor 10 different. There's a factor 10 offset, so they use up their gas in about 100 mega years. And, you know, you could also choose to fit this with one slope. This is actually where, you know, the Schmidt-Kennicott slope 1.4 comes from, because it includes, you know, main sequence galaxies and ULERGs. You can have two sequences. You can have bimodal or running conversion factors. And there's, you know, this is also what Eva talked about with Mark Sargent's two star formation mode model. This sort of this idea. There's lots of subtleties here. If you look at now, this is the latest compilation by Gensel 2015. Based on FIPS and FIPS2, you know, also using lower redshift samples. What's plotted here on the y-axis is the depletion time, again, for main sequence. So, okay, I should first explain the x-axis. The x-axis is just the offset from the main sequence. So zero means you're sitting on the main sequence. These are the starbursts, and these are the red and dead galaxies. And you see for the main sequence galaxies, it doesn't really matter at what redshift you are. The depletion time is always around 1 giga year. Okay, this is the same thing that we saw before. But, you know, you see the scatter is actually enormous. And the question is, you know, what is giving rise to this scatter? So then in Gensel et al., you know, they also went through the exercise to do this not only using the CO line, but also the, you know, fitting the dust emission as good as they can. And, you know, you get a very similar picture. Okay.
So the x-axis there, that's the deviation from the main sequence.
Correct. So this will be a factor 10 above the main sequence, a factor 100 above the main sequence. So I really should move on. So you could say, well, that's great. You know, we have this measurement. We have sort of this measurement. Is this already the answer, right? Can we just say, we can just replace, we can just plug in our favorite relation here, and then invert, going, you know, replace star formation rate with molecular gas, and this would be the relation that we get. You know, this would be a very simplistic view. Mark Sargent actually went through this much more carefully with his two star formation mode model, and he sort of predicts that the H2 density should look something like this. That it may well be the answer, right? It may well be that by looking at a few main sequence galaxies, we get the answer. But I think, you know, what really is needed is sort of an unbiased census of molecular gas. And you can achieve this through a molecular deep field. So this is the same idea as the original deep fields. You just point your telescope at a position on the sky, and you just see what's there. Okay, this is the same spirit as the Hubble deep field and you know, many other deep fields. So I will talk about two deep field efforts here. One is the Plateau de Bure effort, and then our very recent ALMA, pretty significant effort to make this measurement and other measurements. So let me start with the Plateau de Bure. So the problem that both Plateau de Bure or NEEMA or ALMA have in common is that the field of view is really fairly limited, okay? When you talk to optical folks, they say, you know, our HST has a pencil beam. You know, it's only the, you know, ACS, this is of course with big two, but you know, ACS has 3 by 3 arc minutes. This is so tiny, it's unbelievable. But of course with ALMA or Plateau de Bure, it's even more tiny, right? So you should probably refer to these as a sharp pencil beam or something like that. So we could only look at the small area, and with ALMA we did the same thing, of course not in the Hubble Deep Field North, but in the UDF. But this is sort of the overall main limitation currently, okay, as we will see in the end. The area is limited. Okay, so with the Plateau de Bure we cover the full 3 millimeter band. So what you basically do is you step through that band, you have to retune the receivers, and you stare at the same position, and you just redo your measurement by changing the frequencies, because we cannot cover the entire 3 millimeter band in one shot. And you already see what's happening, right? If we just concentrate on that field, we observe the CO 1 to 0 line in this redshift range, then we get the 2 to 1 line in this redshift range, and so on, and the things start overlapping, and you get a fairly, you know, I mean, there's only few gaps here. In redshift space when you do this. The volumes that you cover are small, of course, in particular for the 1 to 0 line. You know, the cosmic volume is indeed very, very small for that. What we want is pretty uniform RMS, and we have, I guess, achieved that. The plot to the right basically just shows that this is the limiting luminosity that we reach with our setup as a function of redshift. And what's plotted here in colors is all these 200 previous CO detections. And it's just demonstrating that we would have detected all of these galaxies. Okay, so we're going pretty deep. This was a 200-hour on-source Plateau de Bure effort. So this was pretty significant. And then what we get is we get a big data cube, right? We have right ascension declination, and then the z-axis is frequency or redshift. And we spend a lot of time developing the tools to find emission in these cubes, right? So most of this cube is noise, right? And there's a few galaxies that may have line emission, and identifying that line emission is rather tricky. And if you're interested in this, we can certainly talk about that later. These are the line candidates in the Hubble Deep Field North that we got. I will go through some of them. One very interesting case is one case where we found two line detections in our 3 millimeter band, which already tells you, if you remember the previous plot, it has to be at higher redshift because only then do things overlap. There's nothing visible in the HST image. You know, just to be sure that we have a real line, we got a VLA 2 to 1 line and also a C plus line with Plateau de Bure. This really nails the redshift of this particular source to be a redshift 5.183. And this coincides with this, you know, early scuba detection, you know, the first submillimeter source ever obtained called HDF 850.1, which is, you know, forming stars. If you compare that star formation rate of that one single object, it forms more stars than all the other galaxies in the UDF combined. We could also get some high resolution imaging in the continuum. This is where the source is. Again, there's nothing in the optical. It's just very dust obscured. And the beauty about, you know, the UDF or the HDF for these deep fields in particular is that you have an amazing database You can go back to the optical redshifts and the optical properties of the galaxies in the vicinity. And in this particular case, we could show that there's indeed a overdensity of sources at exactly that redshift of that submillimeter galaxy, and that there's also a quasar at the very same redshift. So there's a small overdensity already at redshift 5.18. Going through some of the galaxies, I don't have time to talk about all of them, of course, but just to give you an idea of what we get, you know, in some cases we get two lines. What we always get is, you know, a beautiful SED, spectral energy distribution, because, you know, we have all this amazing data sitting on disk from HST, Spitzer, in some cases also Herschel.
When you have some lines, do you find evidence for subterminal excitation?
Right. So, I mean, the lines we're talking about, we never really go above J equals 4. So, and up to that, yes, it is subterminal, but it's not, you know, it's a factor maybe 2 or so below thermal emission. There's another case, you know, faint galaxy at redshift 2.04. This is a case, something happened here with the shifting. But the question is, you know, you see a line here, and you only have one line. The question is, what redshift is it? In this case, we also had HST GRISM spectroscopy by Ben Wiener, and we could really nail down the redshift for this one to be 2.047. We also have, in some cases, you know, these very curious sources where we see pretty convincing line, okay? This is actually one of the brightest lines that we have. But then if we look at the deepest images, we really don't see an optical counterpart. We are actively trying to get additional line confirmation for these things, because these could be potentially be very interesting, right? So this could, we have two lines.
Is this sigma level of the two?
Well, it always depends on how you define sigma. But yeah, this is not looking so great. I agree. We can then plot our objects. These are just the two objects that I just shown you, the gas mass fraction, and then again in our star formation law image, you know, they add to the scatter, okay? And in this plot, I think, you know, you find them below this relation, which is actually not so unsurprising, because you select them by having a large H2 mass, right? So you select them by looking at this axis, and then you measure the far infrared properties or the star formation rate. So I would say that with these blind surveys, if these sources existed, right, if there were objects that have a lot of molecular gas but not so much star formation rate, this would be the regime that will be populated by these kind of surveys.
So you discovered them from line.
Exactly. This is just.
And you detected them in the continuum to get the far infrared.
Right. So in these two cases, yes. Right. So, but then of course we have also this dark galaxy where we can just plot an upper limit here, and we don't know what. Okay. But, you know, this needs confirmation. This we haven't published yet, because we really want to be very sure before we claim that we have like this super dark molecular gas rich galaxy at redshift 2, which would of course be awesome. Well, then, you know, we can build up the CO luminosity functions with our blind constraints. We're doing this for three redshift bins here. I'm plotting here redshift 0, the Dujan-Keras luminosity function, which is still the only CO luminosity function at redshift 0. I mean, somebody has to do something about it. Not that it's bad work, but we should be able to do. This is already pretty old measurement. This is from Virgo. And then we can overplot on this a number of theoretical predictions. And Claudia was, of course, talking about this two weeks ago. But there's other people, Daniel Obreshkov and Gergo Popping. I mean, they're all doing to first order the same thing using semi-analytical models and then using recipes of different kinds. And then, you know, we have also Mark Sargent's two star formation mode model. And you already see there's quite some discrepancy between these various models. And then here are our admittedly pretty rough constraints from this Plateau de Beer effort, okay? So we have really no constraints at redshift 0 because the volume that we probe is just way too small. But then we start to put constraints here in the ratio of 1.5 and 2.7 bin. And the caveat obviously is small number statistics and the small volume that is covered, but our measurements are actually a little above these predictions, okay? What is interesting, this has nothing to do with molecular gas. If you look at this recent review by Rachel Somerville and Roville Tame, 2015, so this is basically one of their plots, figure I think 14 or so, where they compare, you know, various SAMs, semi-analytical models, and hydrodynamical simulations, different colors. So these are the colored lines, and they plot on the y-axis the plot that we have looked at earlier, star formation rate, and on the x-axis the stellar mass. And what you see in these symbols are the actual measurements. And what all these models have in common is that they underpredict the amount of star formation, right? By quite a factor, redshift 1 and 2. And of course, they are made to fit at redshift 0, okay? And this could be part of a similar problem, right? We appear to detect more molecular gas, of course, with, you know, much larger error bars than these measurements. But it's something to keep in mind. We can then talk about the cosmic H2 density plot. So this is basically the star formation rate plot, but, you know, we replace the y-axis with the gas density. And again, we have the measurement at redshift 0 by Susan Karish. We can plot these various models. Again, these are from the SAMs. This is Mark Sargent's two star formation rate model. And just as a reminder, this is how the stellar mass is building up, okay, as a function of time. This is rho stellar mass. And then the H1 mass is, of course, you know, rather flat. This is all through, or at high redshifts, all through absorption measurements, right? So it's unclear whether you actually trace the central disk of a galaxy that could form stars or just some outskirts.
Is that DLA mostly?
That is mostly DLA, exactly. There's now some debate whether there's a change here at redshift 3 or 4. And okay, so then these are the constraints that we got from Plateau de Bure. So yeah, you could say, well, that's pretty laughable, right? The error bars are not so great, but, you know, this was really meant to be also a demonstrator that we can do this kind of measurement. And of course, you know, we do get these blind constraints, and I will show you the ones from ALMA in just a second that have much smaller error bars. So this is looking pretty good. And this was also then a main motivation for us to look at the UDF with ALMA. So this is a 40-hour ALMA effort. 20 hours were spent on the band 3, which is the same band as we used with Plateau de Bure, and then we also have 20 hours in band 6. So we did a full frequency scan in both bands using, you know, 10 setups in band 6 and 5 setups in band 3.
Okay.
Yep.
So it seems like in your CO function, you don't really sample where the break is.
Correct.
Plot is right. So how do you integrate then to get the total?
We have not. We have what we have plotted here. Is no extrapolation whatsoever. This is just our measurement. I should have pointed that out.
Okay.
So this is basically,
so
right,
your actual value, if it would integrate,
would be higher.
Higher.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's actually an important point that I left out. So we only take this measurement,
yeah,
and ask how much, you know, mass is that at that redshift. There's no attempt to extrapolate to larger or smaller luminosities because, yeah, so you're right. So we think we are at the knee, so we should measure the bulk,
yeah,
by a factor of 2. But, you know, the measurement that I'm plotting here does not account for that. So, yes, we would have a measurement that is higher than this.
So is the meaning of the colored area with this, is it 1 sigma, 2 sigma, or how should I interpret this?
The fundamental issue that we are facing is that the galaxies that we detect are not 100 sigma, so they're low sigma. There are a few galaxies where we have a very secure detection where we say, well, this is certainly aligned, there's no question. This gives us the lower limit here, right? And then we go through a lot of statistical analysis, you know, inverting the cubes, looking for negative sources, trying to see how many of the positive looking, the good looking ones are actually real. And then assuming that they're all real, this gives us the upper limit.
So it's positive and negative, essentially, that gives you the...
Exactly, exactly. Okay, so then, you know, this is just the next, it's just showing the observational data of lots of tunings in the 1 millimeter band. This is the 3 millimeter band, a few less tunings. But, you know, to first order, we are factor three better than with the Plateau de Beer survey. And of course, the 1 millimeter regime was so far completely unconstrained. So this is now our 1 millimeter continuum map. So I should say, right, by doing this scan, we do this to find lines, but of course we can also just collapse everything and get a continuum map, which is what we have done here. This is the deepest map so far with ALMA, 13 microgensky. We have over a dozen detections in this field. And if you checked AstroPH this morning, there's also a paper out by Jin Dunlop, who has actually looked at the entire UDF, not just, you know, this one arc minute, but the entire UDF with ALMA. His RMS is a factor three, I believe, or 2.5 worse than this. And he finds the same sort of numbers over the entire UDF. Of course, you know, he's more shallow, and we go a little deeper here. So it turns out that these surveys are very highly complementary. He was only doing the continuum and you know, has very little line information. So the nice thing about the UDF, I think, you know, Nick Scoville referred to this as, at some point, as instant gratification for his Cosmos field, that once you have something interesting in the field, you immediately have all the multi-wavelength data available. So you can characterize all these galaxies in this field. There's actually 1,000 galaxies in just this field that is plotted here. There's about 10,000 galaxies in the entire UDF. And for each of these galaxies, you know, we have multi-wavelength SEDs, and we can constrain, this has nothing to do with the ALMA data, right? We can constrain the stellar mass and the star formation rate through SED fits. And we have done this using Elisabetta D'Acunha's MACFIS fits. And this is what you get. Basically, you recover the main sequence, right? This is not too unexpected, but you know, the stellar mass and the star formation rate we can, of course, use to put things in context later on. So this is now, I just have a few slides on the continuum measurements, and then I will go back to the line measurements. I think I'm fine. I hope I'm fine.
Yes, absolutely.
Actually, yeah, we started a little late, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's why.
Okay.
Right.
So this is what everybody does when they do continuum maps. They do number counts. So what's plotted here on the y-axis is, you know, the number of sources above a certain flux density as a function of flux density. And all these Kuba surveys and Mambo surveys and La Boca surveys, they were targeting these objects. These are the submillimeter galaxies, right? This is above 1 millijansky, few millijanskys at 850 micron. This has been constrained quite vigorously over the last 10 years. And then, you know, this is sort of what has been added in mostly through ALMA studies that were more shallow. And then this is now the yellow points are our own data points, which, you know, are, you know, in surprising agreement with these other lines, considering that our area is quite tiny, right? We're only looking at the one arc minute field, so we were really concerned that cosmic variance may completely kill us, but maybe we just were lucky. But within a factor of, you know, two or so, everything is fine. And of course, we can also compare our measurement to the cosmic infrared background. There's some new precise measurements from Planck, shown here. This is just the Planck CIB functional frequency. You know, we are measuring here now at 230 gigahertz. This is the Planck measurement, right? This is our measurement. So, sorry, I should say, this is just Jansky's per square degree, right? You just count up all the flux and extrapolate. So this is the number that we get when we look at all the objects that we individually detect. Now we recover about half of the CIB. So this is going to 60% of the CIB, you know, all our detections. Of course, we can also stack our map because we know where the galaxies sit from the UDF images. And when we do that, we get this yellow point. It's about 80% of the cosmic infrared background. Of course, the CIB is also a big average over everything. But, you know, we are not off by a large factor, which is good. just a few snapshots of what these galaxies look like in the Alma Dust Continuum. They're all very red in the HST images. These are the Alma images. What is sort of a little surprising, and turns out I just looked at the Dunlop paper this morning, they find exactly the same. Of course, you know, they go less shallow, but they have better number statistics because they have a larger field. But basically, we don't detect a galaxy with a stellar mass lower than 10 to the 10 solar masses, and star formation rates starting at about 10 or so. And this could be, you know, if you compare this now to all these previous submillimeter galaxy surveys, which is shown here, you know, there's the Weiss et al., which is in the La Boca survey, other SCUBA surveys. So there's this huge debate in the submillimeter galaxy community, you know, where does this distribution peak, depending on whether you look at lens samples or not. But the general consensus is that these galaxies peak at redshift 3 or 4. We certainly don't see that, right? We have a peak below redshift 2. But this also shouldn't be so unsurprising, right? Because we are just not sampling. I mean, we have our volume. The chance that we look at an SMG is just zero, right, to first order. So then we can also put this plot. Again, this is just the star formation rate as a function of stellar mass. And in yellow, we circle those objects that we have detected with ALMA. Again, it's very similar to the previous plots. You know, we only detect stuff in the upper right. This is now at redshift 1 to 2, and this is at redshift 2.5, where we only have one source detected. Of course, we can push this further through stacking. So we go, you know, we stack using different mass samples. And you can already tell from this, you know, we don't really recover so much. You know, it's we were hoping to get more. The detection fraction is about 50%, or, you know, up to 100% above stellar masses of redshift 10 to the 10. But we don't detect anything in the low stellar mass end. And this actually, we can. So when we look at the smaller 10 to the 10 solar masses, and this is now, see, this was done at redshift 2 to 3, this plot. This is done for galaxies redshift 4 to 10. Now we have all these beautiful UV measurements from HST. We can basically rule out all possible SEDs that people have, you know, proposed in the past. You know, okay, up to 20, sure, you know, that's easy. But even the dwarfs, you know, we should have detected. So this is a big puzzle, and you know, Richard Bowens also just submitted a nice paper. We actually submitted seven papers on this just over the last month or so. So Richard Bowens' paper is one of them, talking about the IRX beta relation. So this is IRX beta redshift 2 to 3 between redshift 4 and 10, showing the usual Galzetti and SMC curves, and basically. Okay, ignore all these small points because these are all upper limits. If you look at the stacks, you know, we actually rule out the Calcite dust extinction or the SMC dust extinction, certainly for the larger redshift greater 4 sources. And what this means, and you know, of course, Richard is very excited about this. We are certainly not excited about this, is that when you go to the very high redshift, the dust extinction apparently doesn't play as big of a role as people have thought before. So this was a
masses you're probing. So if you would have higher stellar mass objects, that would be different.
That is correct, right? So this, but you know, again, the density of these objects is much less, right? But you're right. This needs to be folded in here. This is just something that. So this is Richard's typical plot, and now he says, you know, it's going down faster than previously thought because usually they have corrected, you know, their UV measurements assuming a certain IRX beta. The caveat here is the dust temperature, so there could, well, we can talk about this if you're interested. I really need to move on. So this is now the CO measurements. I will be very brief. I'm just showing a few examples here so that you get an idea of what kind of galaxies we detect. If you look at these galaxies, we detect none of these galaxies, but this little red faint blob that is sort of hidden behind the brighter blob. very bright detections in continuum, and the line, beautiful line, you get line excitation measurements. You have beautiful SEDs. There's another galaxy. This is redshift 1.3. This galaxy, which you know actually doesn't show up in the optical HST images, only if you add in the infrared, the very deep infrared images, you see a beautiful disk with a nucleus. You know, again, you know, we have nice detection here, some constraints on the excitation. Another more phase-on galaxy, you know, actually looks like a beautiful spiral that we have detected. This is actually very clear detection. It doesn't look so great in this presentation, but trust me, there's another possibly merging object. Anyway, so we can now put all these objects on the plots that you already have been introduced to. Again, infrared luminosity as a function of CO luminosity. And we add in the new measurements here. And it really just shows you that, you know, these scaling relations, they work, you know, globally. But if you want to know the gas mass of a particular galaxy, I mean, they really fail. And I think, you know, if that is just something that one really needs to keep in mind. What we have added here for the first time are objects. So I've been talking about objects down here before, where we say, okay, we have a bright CO line, but nothing in the optical, this would populate this plot. You can populate this plot if you have big star formers, you know, high star formation rates, but very little CO. Of course, these measurements have never been published in the past. You know, people have looked at a galaxy, they didn't detect CO, they thought, you know, maybe the wrong redshift, who knows what's going on, let's just ignore that. In our case, you know, we have superb SEDs for all these galaxies. In many galaxies, we have a spectroscopic redshift, and we're just falling in the MUSE data also for the UDF. So we really know exactly where the CO line should be, and there are some galaxies that are shown here as upper limits here, where we really thought we should have detected a nice CO line, right? We would have, if these things were here, you know, we certainly would have detected a 10, 15 sigma line, and we have not. So we are not only populating this regime down here, but also here. And I'm really wrapping up, sorry.
These are very low mass galaxies or not? Just a question.
Well, these are actually high mass. So these are, yeah, if you look at the mass metallicity relation, right, you can't really blame potentially low metallicity for the faintness. Okay. Now here, coming back to Robert's question earlier, is again, H2 luminosity functions or CO luminosity functions for the different redshift bins. These are the two measurements that I've talked about earlier from Plateau de Bure, and now we're approaching, you know, error bars and samples where we can start to constrain where this break in the knee of the luminosity function is happening. Okay.
So are recursive the same models as before?
Yeah, this is exactly the same models, right? And then this is also the same plot as I've shown you earlier, the Plateau de Bure error bars, and now on top of this, the ALMA error bars. So with ALMA, the nice thing is we actually can go down to redshift zero. But there is, you know, there is this apparent drop. You can still fit it with a line of unity, but you know, I think there's some good evidence that there is a drop. It's not a factor of 20, as we see in the cosmic star formation rate. But you know, at least it looks like a factor of 5. And again, these red regions, this is entirely from the ALMA data, right? There's nothing else folded in but the redshift. So, you know, considering that, you know, if you compare this to the star formation rate plot, considering that this took 20 years to compile, maybe we shouldn't feel so bad about this. In fact, you know, if you just look at an area that is 5 times larger, you know, these error bars are all Poisson error bars. So these error bars, they will go down. And of course, we don't know what the value is, but you know, you could constrain this much better. And this is something that we hope we will get ALMA time for.
In cycle 4. How much do you think cosmic variance could still play a role?
Right, so you can. Yeah, right. So, I mean, there's cosmic variance calculators available. And if you plug in the UDF, you know, there's always a factor 50% that things can go up and down. But also comparing to the infrared background, I think, you know, we you know, a factor, maybe a factor 2, but not a factor 10, okay? And of course, you know, this will have to be repeated not only for the UDF, but for other fields. Okay, I don't have time for this. Basically, you know, I showed you that the redshift, if you look at the C+ line, you can look at objects between redshift 6 and 8. And of course, you know, there's all these dropout candidates in the field, the I and the C drops, by Richard Bounds and Garth Illingworth and all these people, Richard Ellis. We have looked at these positions, trying to detect the C+ line. And in fact, you know, we find a lot of lines that are looking pretty good. These are just at the positions of the known dropouts in the redshift range where we expect the actual redshift to be. And this has been a very frustrating experience, quite frankly, because when you go through the numbers, you know, these lines look all pretty good. You know, we look for the negative peaks as well, you know, because you wouldn't expect negative sources with the same signal noise. We get way more positive than negative, so you think, well, that's pretty good. And they all look good. I've seen worse published. But then if you plot what the implications would be, for example, you plot on the C+ luminosity on the y-axis, star formation rate on the x-axis. These are local relations from Deleuze and Gonzalo Afonso. Now, this is where our data points are. I mean, they're way above this relation. You know, it's implausible, I would think, but we just need deeper data, and we actually have ALMA DDT time in the queue and also much deeper cycle 3 observations to shed more light on this. If you compare this now to models by Swinbank, you know, this is number density as a function of, this is just a C+ luminosity function. You know, we get numbers that are much higher if all these were real than predicted by simple models. Even if one source were real, we are above this. So, you know, this is potentially extremely exciting, but, you know, we just, you know, this kind of quality is not sufficient. You know, even though this looks pretty nice, you really want, you know, 2 or 3 times that signal to noise. Okay, wrapping up very quickly. So I think this is just the beginning, okay? This is expensive, right? So the community needs to decide whether or not this is a useful avenue to pursue. The nice thing here is also, you know, with JWST coming online, that if you talk to the GTO teams, I'm in the MIRI team on the European side, everybody will be looking at the UDF. Okay, that is the prime field for JWST in the first year of the mission. So it seems sort of urgent to get complementary ALMA data on that field. And there's, I just briefly highlighted these apparent tensions between the observations and some of the theoretical models. And I will just stop here. Thank you. I'm sorry for being so long. I shouldn't have shown the movie in the beginning. That those were the 2 minutes that. I'm just kidding.
So, Fabian, do you have any? I asked already the same question to Eva before, but so do you have any indication or information on the kinematics of the CO as you go to high redshift or at any redshift, or some indication how the dispersions are changing as a function of mass and or redshift?
No, so I mean, yeah, that would need spatially resolved imaging.
But don't you have it for some at
least? No, the resolution here was 1.5 arc seconds, so. And that was specifically chosen to capture the entire emission.
Sure.
You don't want too high, yeah, but, you know, indeed, we in cycle 3, we try to get time to, you know, follow some of these objects up at higher resolution, but it's very expensive, right? I mean, other groups have the same problem. If you want a nice map of the main sequence galaxies at redshift 1.5 in CO, where you can really trust dispersion measurements,
right,
you know, over just 10 pixels, you know, we're not talking 100 pixels. Yes. That's 20 hours, okay? That's one galaxy 20 hours with ALMA. And, you know, eventually this will be done, but, you know, given the current pressure, it's just, yeah.
Awesome.
But yeah, I think it would be extremely nice to get such a measurement.
So would the observations of the length galaxies, would they give the velocity dispersion, or is that unambiguous hygiene observation?
I mean, what you also want, you know, you do not only want the dispersion of the gas. You also want a star formation rate map from deep HST images. You want the stellar mass map. You want to, you know, put that dispersion.
Because you want
to put it in context, right?
But there are, I mean, yeah, it's a good point. I guess there are, I don't remember what the other groups have that experiment. I think there are some that have
tried. There's the long baseline campaign. They did one lens galaxy, and several groups published papers on those data sets.
Swinbeck.
Well, that's the eyelash. So Mark Swinbeck published this a few years back, and yeah, they got dispersions of order 60 to 80 kilometers per second. What Eva's referring to is this STP-81 source, where Alma, you know, the very long baseline, this beautiful ring.
Yeah.
I don't know whether people, they must have looked into the dispersion. That's an interesting suggestion. But yeah, for these normal unlensed objects, it's expensive. Okay.